Hi, guys, and welcome to this episode of What the Cluck, a podcast devoted to keeping chickens for fun and self-sufficiency. I'm Maya with Frugal Chicken, and in this episode, we talk to Karen Thompson of Little Suburban Homestead. Now, Karen has a suburban homestead, and one reason I wanted her on the show was that she has a ton of advice for people who live in suburbia but want to keep chickens but are concerned about their neighbors and what their neighbors might think. So in this episode, we talk a lot about how to raise chickens in a suburban homestead and keep your neighbors happy. So enjoy the show. So welcome, Karen. Thank you for joining
me. Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, I'm excited to hear about your story. So let's get right into things and tell me a little bit about yourself, your chickens, your homestead, and everything.
Well, I can't tell the whole story because I would go on and on. But basically, me and my husband, I call the Viking. We are suburban homesteaders. This really started back in like 1989, but it came full circle in 2010 when it was the year after I had been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And I had decided that we needed to get off the chemicals and get off the processed foods and get healthy and get back to the basics. So that's kind of where our blog, Lil, L-I-L, Suburban Homestead, began. So we've evolved because we're almost empty nesters now. At one point we had smaller children. So I think that takes on, like, my blog has taken on a different tone over time. So I think that's important to know that at one point we had 29 chickens on a third of an acre. Now we have 4 chickens on a third of an acre. Oh, wow. At one point we were just getting into beekeeping, and now at any given time we have 3 to 5 hives going on with the bees and honey harvesting every year. So I just think it's really important to recognize that we have seasons in our life. I work full time in my dream job in public relations now. So I used to work for the school system and I have the summers off. So that being said, I should share that, you know, I was a podcaster, as you know. That's why I was excited to be interviewed by you, because I have over 50 live shows at America's Preppers Network. I have shows with the Survival Mom, and I've written for Fix.com, From Scratch Magazine, Prepare Magazine, and I'm member of the Grit blogging community, and I'm also a blogging community member of our local paper, The Star News. So it's just kind of, it's been exciting because I've had more time to freelance write, and I've had more time to get in the garden because my last kid at home is in college. So we're not officially in the empty nest, but that's kind of like the nutshell version. But we can definitely explore more of those areas, but that's kind of my life in a nutshell.
That's great. Yeah, I know for us, you know, we're in that little tiny kid phase of our lives. We have 2 toddlers, and, you know, we're able, because we have this huge farm, we're able to, you know, have all these animals and all these, you know, 200 chickens and everything. But before we moved here, we actually lived in a condo, and we couldn't have, you know, any of that stuff. So there definitely are phases of your life that, you know, will dictate the kind of homesteader that you are, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, now that I'm looking at, you know, the years and how it kind of evolved, because we lived on some land and we had some acreage. We didn't have chickens and we had ponies and we had a garden. And then later in life, you know, we're in the townhouse kind of years and condo years, moving around with small children. Then we had a historic home that we flipped that was a 100-year-old home, which I share about in my blog, too, and I have a podcast on that, too. But then that was when we got back into the chickens and the gardening, when I was home with my children. And then, obviously, now I'm back to work full time. So I think for many families, not all families, but we're definitely the kind of family that lives to different rhythms of what's going on, and we just kind of go with the flow. So my husband does more cooking now because, I mean, I might get home later than him several days. Mm-hmm. So we just work together as a team.
That's great. So tell us about your chickens. You said you have 4 now, and you said in the pre-interview, you said that you're passionate about suburban living, so in suburban homesteading. So
suburban homesteading, yeah.
I misspoke there a little bit. You said you're passionate about suburban homesteading and the chickens. So tell us about your chickens and your flock and your coop and how all of that sort of came about and maybe some of the struggles you've had with it.
Oh, yeah. I think suburban homesteading, we have a whole different host of problems. Number one, not being possums and raccoons, but neighbors. Because, and I actually wrote a blog post about that for the grit blogging community, because I'm going to tell you the number one thing that you can do to get your neighbors on board is to communicate with them. You thought I was going to say give them eggs and honey, but that's the number two thing. That's the number two thing. But the number one thing is explaining about the honeybees and how important they are to the planet. And now I will say the chickens, 29 of them, it was getting out of hand. Because even with three of us taking, that was me, my husband, and my son all helping out, and it just was too much for a suburban homestead environment. We're down to four. They're in a chicken tractor. It's like the third chicken tractor my husband has designed. We're so OCD, we're getting ready to redesign another chicken tractor because we always just want to keep making it better. We want to make it, we're both working full time. So everything you're going to see, like my tagline, I have a couple of taglines. I never could brand myself really perfectly, but one of them is sustainable living on a budget. Well, that was my first tagline. The tagline I've been using the last couple of years is where homesteading and innovation meet. When you work full time, both of us outside the home, we have to be efficient. And looking at how we're dealing with the chicken tractor, that's so important. I will tell you, we have four chickens. You'll recognize all the breeds. We have a Barred Rock. We have a Rhode Island Red. We have a Buff Orpington, and she is old for a chicken, but I told my husband she's still laying, although he's like, there's only three eggs. But I'm like, I know the red one's molting, so I know she's laying. And then we have an Americana or Araucana. People argue about what's a true Americana or Araucana, but you guys, it lays green eggs. I'm happy.
That's what matters, yeah.
Exactly. I'm not like, I have a friend, Dana with Ozark Orpingtons, and you can, I mean, I'm not plugging her except that if you're a chicken lover, and obviously, I mean, you guys are because you're following the frugal chicken here. She does chickens for show. She's not a blogger, and I'm just saying there are some people that are really specific into the breeds and for show. We are doing it because we're passionate about raising farm fresh eggs out back. And we have the raised bed gardens, and we are going to grow a boatload of food this year because this is the first year I have no other obligations this summer but my garden. I've even planned all my travel plans for early in the season or late in the season so that it is the year of the garden. I put that on, I have a Pinterest board called the Year of the Garden, and that's how I feel. I'm just so excited. Like, I want to grow more kohlrabi. I want to grow, anyway, but you were asking me about the chickens. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, it's okay because all that, it all goes together. And one thing I tell people is to try and grow as much for their chickens as possible in their gardens. And particularly if you're someone who's on a budget, maybe affording, grain every week isn't in your budget. But if you can grow, stuff that the chickens can eat, that's always a really good thing to do. But I'm curious to know a little bit more about how you've dealt with your neighbors, because I know that a lot of people that listen to the podcast are, in areas where they either have HOAs or they have limitations and or they're around your neighbors and stuff like that. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you've kind of gotten your neighbors on board and sort of some tips for that.
Well, we're really fortunate because we do not have an HOA or any covenants. So we are very fortunate with that. So we could have 29 chickens. The number one way was one thing is typically we'll put our home on local greenhouse tours or coastal. We have a coastal coop tour that I've been on every year. And it's really funny because the people that want to see the fancy little chicken houses, and I'm not knocking you guys. Like, I think they're awesome. People that have the vinyl siding and the beautiful windows is beautiful. We don't have that kind of chicken yard. We have it is fenced with like the metal concrete fencing, and it's got a chicken tractor that kind of goes up to it. It's simple. Everything about our lives basically is simple. So my strategy with our neighbors is really simple. Communicate. We do put up a lot of like water fly traps and different fly traps in the yard because it's 100 and some degrees here in coastal North Carolina. We do share eggs when we have an abundance of eggs. With four chickens, we don't have an abundance of eggs, but we do share when we can. Another thing, though, that I'm going to get back to the open houses the neighbors really like to kind of wander over and meet the chickens, and I put out like oatmeal or other things that they can feed the chickens. And that has really, really helped with some barriers. And then there's the other issues, like, I mean, we have one neighbor that's not really crazy about our suburban homesteading life, is that we've just kind of had to push more of our stuff over to the other side of the yard and do more of the gardening on their side of the yard. So, I mean, in the end, I mean, we're really not going crazy right now. We have two beehives out back, four chickens. We mostly have food. And I don't know. I don't know how anybody could object to food being grown. So,
Well, it's interesting. I really love that idea of the coop tour, because I have a friend right now that's actually in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and
not far from
her,
me.
exactly, yeah, and her town is having a huge fight where they don't want anyone to have the chickens, and it's sort of like this big mess.
Crazy.
Yeah, and it all started with one neighbor having chickens and then another neighbor having a problem with the chickens and some sort of court battle and on and on. But something like a coop tour might be a good, really good way to, they're looking for ways to reach out to the community to start to, get people on board with keeping chickens and stuff. So that might be a really excellent way for them to start doing that. And I'll pass that idea on to her.
Well, and another thing is, think about it. In England and in Europe and many places for hundreds of years, I mean, people that live in apartments or condos or townhouses will have two chickens out in their little garden because there it's very normal. They call their little patio area a garden, And I'm wondering why aren't we getting on board with this progressive way of thinking that to be able to go out to the coop in the morning and pull two eggs out for breakfast, I mean, it might be that's what you get that morning for breakfast. Maybe you each get a slice of toast and an egg. I challenged myself one year. It's kind of fun. And I mean, I wasn't 100% clearly because, I like steak and stuff. But one year we challenged ourselves to really eat primarily out of the garden. I think it was 2011. We hardly bought any groceries that year. And it was so much fun to just go out. Of course, that was the year we had the ridiculous amount of chickens for suburban homestead. But I mean, we have plenty of eggs. So we would have eggs every morning, eggs for lunch. I mean, I incorporated recipes for dinner with eggs. But I mean, it was neat in a way. It was very empowering. Isn't it neat when you grow your own food and because you're on a farm,
Exactly, yeah.
it's very empowering to be like, we grew this. And we're eating this, and we don't need to rely on the grocery store. I think it's so cool. And I remember when I first started blogging back, well, with Little Suburban Homestead, I blogged prior to that, but for other blogs. But when I first started blogging for Little Suburban Homestead, so many people said to me, "Oh, this is just a fad." Well, 6 years later, and my lifestyle hasn't changed. If anything, we're going to be adding some quail and, we're going to be adding, like, we want to do a little fish farm. So I always say that wrong. I think it's aquaponics. I think we're going to get into aquaponic gardening. So if anything, I see us trying to become more innovative and more efficient. I don't see this lifestyle going away for us.
Yeah, it's the same here. And actually, it's funny that you bring up the aquaponics because we went to the feed store today to buy grain for the animals here. And we noticed that they're now selling fish. They have the order form so you can order the amount of fish that you want. I said to my husband, I was like,
Yay.
yeah, and I was like, bluegills are 65 cents each. I was like, we might as well just buy some, and it'll at least put a deadline down where we have to start getting the aquaponics and gear because we've been meaning to do it for a couple of years now and just haven't gotten around to it. But forcing ourselves to get into it with buying, ordering these bluegills, a really great way to, start getting involved with that.
I think it's really interesting, and it's another reason why I love connecting with bloggers such as yourself and even on Twitter. There's so many people that aren't blogging that are doing some really cool stuff. And there was this guy I was talking to on Twitter from Australia. And I was telling him we were thinking about getting into the aquaponics. But I was also explaining we had some fish allergies in our family. And he said, but not shellfish allergies. We don't have any shellfish allergies. He said, "Have you thought about," and he called them some name, they call them in Australia. I can't even remember. But he said, "Have you thought about growing, like, I guess, crawfish, like what we have, like, down in the bayou in Alabama?" And I said, I hadn't. And he said, they're so easy to grow in an aquaponic
Oh,
system.
God.
And I thought, and apparently a lot of fish that's legal here is illegal in Australia. I think salmon,
Yeah.
I don't know if it's tilapia is illegal in Australia. Well, I told him I didn't want tilapia. I didn't want to grow tilapia. So we're actually considering growing crawfish if I can get my hands on some. And if I do, I'll let you know how that goes. But
Yeah.
I think it's cool that you're telling me now that the feed store is getting in on the action or the farm store, because it just tells you, I don't think we're heading in a direction as a society. I think our collective consciousness is heading this way because we all know it's better for us in the long run.
Well, look at what's happening in Venezuela now, where I guess they've declared a state of or a country of emergency because they're out of food. Apparently, the whole nation, you know, because of some of the socialist ideals that they had down there, the whole nation now has declared that they're out of food. And if you look at
that is so sad. I haven't really heard much about that, but don't laugh at me. I mean, my reader, my people that follow me will understand. They'll be like, Carolyn doesn't watch the news ever, which is true, because when I get off work, I just get right to blogging. So that is sad. I will research that. What a sad state of affairs.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, there's a whole undercurrent of thought in the U.S. that, you know, this could really happen to us. So I think that you're right when you say that, you know, the whole lifestyle really isn't going away, and that, you know, people are more and more getting on board with it because we're seeing, you know, a lot of, you know, issues in the world globally where, you know, people need to start growing their own food, and, you know, chickens are part of that.
I agree. And, you know, I just did a little YouTube video just kind of showing people, like, you know, my seeds and this and that. And as I was flipping through the book, I realized some people watching the YouTube would be like, oh, she doesn't use all non-GMO seeds. Well, we started buying seeds like years ago, and I collect and I seed swap.
Uh-huh.
So we are slowly switching over to all heirloom and non-GMO seeds because I do want to protect our food system for the next generation. It's important to me. That being said, I'm not going to throw healthy, viable seeds out. Like,
you know,
some seeds, and I've heard that there was actually somewhere I read where somebody kind of got bashed on social media for not using all non-GMO seeds. And I'm like, okay, first of all, we are not going to end the, I mean, it's not going to happen right away. It's going to be us as a population all slowly moving that way. And change takes time. And nobody, it's just kind of like if you go to the nutritionist, I'm just going to use this as an example because I see a nutritionist. They tell you to go home and throw everything out of your pantry that's bad for you. Okay. So now I'm going to be spending too much money on groceries because I threw away all my food and I have to start over. So I don't ever do that. What I do is I slowly, and like if you open my pantry now, I have nothing fun in there, according to my family. you know what I mean? Like,
sounds like my husband. Yeah.
Every now and then, you know, my husband, who I call the Viking, I'll open the cabinet up and I'll be like, who bought this nasty fake macaroni and cheese? And he'll be like, me, guilty. But I think it's the same way with our seeds. I think it's the same thing even with, like, your chickens. Let's say you decide to change their feed. You don't just throw the old feed out. How many chickens do you have? Did you say you had 200?
We have a lot of chickens, yeah. It's somewhere around 200.
And, I mean, I know I'm not the one interviewing, but I need to talk to you about that. I need to watch one of your podcasts. I would love to hear a podcast from you just all about your farm life and what it's like, because you're right. It is different than reading a blog when we get to talk to each other and be face to face, you know? So, but I know that's not your story today, but I would love to hear more.
Sure. Well, we can definitely do that in a future episode. So one thing that you mentioned that I really love is that one of your chickens is very old for, you know, a chicken, but you still are keeping her and you're telling your husband that she's laying and maybe she is, maybe she isn't. But I love that because it is so important to remember that just because they've stopped living what we call a quote-unquote useful life, that we can't just abandon them. And that's sort of a pet peeve of a lot of chicken owners is, you know, people want chickens, but then when they get old, people don't really know what to do with them because they're not really laying anymore. So that's really commendable that you're doing that.
Well, and I mean, and I don't know where you stand. I mean, obviously, if you have 200 chickens, I'm guessing some of yours are meat chickens, correct?
Yes, so probably about 50 of them are meat chickens.
Okay.
And we have a lot of rooms and stuff.
Yeah, and I think the thing for me is, I mean, I know because, I mean, let's just face it, the homesteaders of years ago, when the chicken stops laying, the chick, I mean, it's chicken and dumplings, you know, or it's, they go in the stew pot, you know, they're culled. I'm just saying, so we have culled some roosters. We have not culled any laying hens yet. Like when we had those 29 chickens and we realized we had too many and that we needed, I didn't even sell them. I gave them I gave them to new chicken mamas to get started on their new chicken mama journey. Or chicken papas, but it was always women that called me about the chickens. So we haven't, but yes, you're right. I mean, I've had Hazel, and she's actually the only chicken that has a name, Hazel, my Buff Orpington. She and people are like, your chickens don't have all, they all have names. That's horrible. I said, well, first of all, when I go out there and I say, here, chicky, chicky, they all come. So, you know, and second of all, I just think I knew that the time would come at some point where I have to cull a chicken. And you know as well as I do, it's a lot harder to cull a chicken when they have a name. So I don't think Hazel will ever get culled. Hazel will probably live out her years. But I think you're right. I think that there's a point to saying it's okay to let a couple of them carry on with their chicken life. They were useful on the homestead. I obviously can't have as many chickens as you might have around that maybe aren't, like you might be able to keep a few more that aren't useful than I am because you have a bigger property and they can free range. But yes, I've grown rather attached and fond of Hazel. And I think Hazel's days are not numbered unless she has them numbered because the Viking doesn't dare. He would not dare. He knows how I feel about her. So, you know, that's just, I think it's good to have that conversation though. And I think it's unrealistic to expect, I know there's been some people like, oh, you should never cull your chickens. I think that's unrealistic. But I do think, like you said, I think it's important to value the contribution that they made to your homestead, whether it's a tiny urban homestead or a large homestead, and try to give them the best. I mean, my chickens have a great quality of life, all four of them. I mean, it's like they won the lottery, you know? And by the way, I'm not saying they get, I've seen some of these bloggers and they, you know, they do some really fancy stuff and I'm not a fancy chicken owner. You know, they get their scratch feed, they get their grain feed, they get to free range in between seasons of the garden, and then I throw weeds at them all year long. So that's their life. But I mean, it's certainly better than the chickens in those factories for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's really good that you bring up the point that, you know, roosters kind of really don't have a place in the suburban homestead. And that's probably one of the biggest problems that a city, for example, will have with somebody keeping chickens is what about the roosters? What about the noise level? What about the manure? So it's really good that you bring that up and you sort of make it okay for people to say, no, I don't want to have a rooster, you know?
I think, I mean, right. I think that people shouldn't feel guilty about it. I also worry if I post a rooster ad on Craigslist that a rooster might get misused. So I feel better about eating the rooster, to be truthful. And it's not the best eating, as you know. You're a farmer, and we all know the meat chickens are the best eating. And then the dual purpose breeds, like the Buff Orpingtons, would be the next best eating. And a rooster is not that good of eating, but I feel it's my due diligence. You know, if we're going to slaughter a rooster, then we eat it. I mean,
That's commendable.
it's delicious, but I mean, it's just not tender like a dual purpose breed would be, or you know. And see, we had to. My son did this for his senior project. It's kind of an interesting story, but I think your listeners will appreciate we got two Rhode Island Reds from this farmer up the road. And I said to her, I said, I'm going to be transparent with you. One of these is going to be called for a senior project because he was doing a farm to table project. And she said, oh, I really hope, you know, you don't do that. But she said, I'll still sell them to you because, you know, we would probably end up slaughtering one of them too. So I said, okay. I mean, this is just the real facts between a farmer and a consumer. And, it ended up being that the Rhode Island Red that I have is the, you know, was in that group. I mean, in the, she was one of the two chickens. And like, I remember my husband saying, well, today is your lucky day, Red, because you weren't the one, you know, you weren't the one picked up for the farm to table project. But that being said, I mean, my son went back and shared with about 60 or 70 other students, three different farm to table type activities he did. He did, the eggs from the chickens, he did the chicken, and then he did an eel that he caught and cooked it up. But the point, I know, I was like, why an eel? I don't think he could catch any fish that day. But the point is, we live 2 miles from the ocean. So that is a nature's bounty that we have access to. We will go Virginia mullet fishing and we can catch like a bucket full, and that's like we like Sunday night dinner for like six to 8 weeks, so.
Yeah, when you said eel, I pretty much figured, you are on the coast, and it makes sense because that's, well, if you remember, the thing, one of the Thanksgiving stories is that that's what they had at the first Thanksgiving was eels because that's what was available,
Exactly. And it probably was more likely that they had duck or goose or eel or whatever. I mean, that just makes sense. Waterfowl, water creatures. Eel is actually very delicious, by the way. And a lot of things that people that are like, oh, I'd never eat that. Never say never, because you might eat it and not know you're eating eel.
Oh, I will. I love sushi. I like eating
Oh,
sushi.
good, good.
So as we get to our the end of our time together, what is some of the advice that you'd like to leave with listeners about, raising chickens in a suburban homestead?
I think my advice is keep it simple. Your coop design on a suburban homestead is so crucial. The tractor works for us because in the summer when the chickens can't get into the garden, which is soon, we're kind of finishing harvesting our winter garden and we're getting all the transplants out within the next month because we're in zone 8B. We're in gardening zone 8B. The tractor can be moved around, so they're aerating the soil, they're getting that fresh food, their manure is kind of going all around our yard, and we can collect it and put it in the compost bin. I would just say raising chickens on a suburban homestead, when you're weeding, remember that's food for your chickens. If you I don't think people always make that connection. You can also, and I go through periods of doing this, but you can take their shells, because they don't get as much like. On farms, chickens have a lot of access to a lot of different soils. They don't have as much access. They've kind of tilled up the soil. So we bring, every time we clean out a garden bed, we throw topsoil in with the chickens. We throw oyster shells in. Sometimes I'll crush eggshells. And I mean, they don't even recognize it as an eggshell by the time it goes back in. So they would never know. I do that seasonally. I don't have as much time for that as others. And fresh water is so critical. Fresh water. Keeping your feed and grain dry. We don't have a barn, so we have trash bins, but we make sure that their feed and everything stays dry. And communicate with your neighbors. I mean, that's what it is for raising chickens on in a suburban homestead environment. And then don't forget, they like treats too. So I always keep like a big bin of oatmeal. I mean, they love leftover peas, and I know there's a certain few no-nos. I actually found out, that you're not supposed to give chickens nightshade plants, like potatoes, tomatoes. But just FYI, before I found that out, I was tossing my chickens, squished cherry tomatoes for years, and they all lived. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying,
Well,
ignorance is bliss.
the tomatoes themselves are actually okay. It's the leaves and like the stems that are an issue. The tomatoes themselves, as long as they're ripe, they're actually okay.
Oh, okay. Then I haven't been killing my chickens.
No, it's the same thing with the potatoes. If you have it's the potato peels, and it's actually the green stuff, because the green stuff is a toxin. So the potato
Okay.
peels that are green, I always tell people just to completely peel the potatoes and then cook the white parts of the potato. But that's okay. But it's the peels and all that, and the vines and everything that have all the toxins in them.
That's great that you did the research on that. I was like not sure, but I stopped feeding my chickens potatoes, but I still, when I have like squishy tomatoes in the garden, I throw them over the fence to them. And then the other thing is my chickens, and I just think people forget what their chickens like. So they just are like, oh, I just give them grains. My chickens love leftover grits. So just about every Sunday morning, I don't give them junk food though. Like I don't do any junk food, but they'll get leftover oatmeal, leftover quinoa, leftover grits, and they love it.
Well, a million thanks for being on the podcast, my very first video podcast. I'm so
I'm
excited.
honored. I feel honored, and I'm so excited. And I would love to come back again sometime.
Well, thank you. And you guys listening, be sure to visit Karen at littlesuburbanhomestead.com. And I hope I got that URL correct. Did I get it correct?
It is. It's littlesuburbanhomestead.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And a million thanks again for being here. And we will see you guys in the next podcast. Sorry,
I lost
that. Okay. Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks.